Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we will be talking with UNC oncologist and breast cancer expert, Dr. Lisa Carey, along with breast cancer survivor Barbara Martin about surviving breast cancer. Just a wonderful opportunity to really hear about this, both from the physician standpoint and also from a real patient surviving breast cancer.
Well, and Christy, this topic is one that's personal to probably every one of our listeners and families, unfortunately, and one that I think we can all learn from, including ourselves and our colleagues. I look forward to that conversation.
But first, we have some research that matters. So the first one's about responsibility and generic drugs compared with brand names.
And it sounds a little legalistic, but we're going to happily translate it into common sense language.
And about should schools be closed during bad flu outbreaks?
Maybe even colleges. And next, about cheerleading injuries and what could be done to reduce them. And is this an important issue?
And finally, about research itself, whether or not you're skeptical of new research, and perhaps should you be?
Well, let's talk then about this first element about generic drugs. And this was a commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine about a Supreme Court decision, which basically said generic drug makers aren't liable if they don't have information on their labels saying what are the side effects of some of their drugs, because maybe they weren't required to by law.
It's tricky because, we know that there are brand names of drugs, and then there are generic drugs, which is the same medicine in its basic chemistry, but made in a generic and cheaper, and pretty much the same medicine for most medicines. They affect people similarly.
And the brand name drugs are required by the Food and Drug Administration to have labels on there that have the side effects. But as new labels come out or new information comes out, perhaps those brand name products, they don't make the drug anymore. But the generic companies keep making the drug because they can make it cheap. And yet they're not required to have those same types of updated information on the labels, the Supreme Court said. So what states are now doing are requiring, are going in and maybe changing the laws, because it should generic drugs be required to have this same information? And perhaps maybe there are new ways that we can provide for drug safety so that our listeners can better understand this, what are really side effects of all these drugs, whether generic or brand names.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's medicine that we're prescribing to our patients, and we as providers need that information for safe prescribing, and our patients need that information so that we can make educated decisions. To me, it seems clear that we should have that information for everybody.
One question just to ask your pharmacist is, are there any side effects of this drug that maybe aren't on the label that I should be aware of? That's one question you could always ask the pharmacist or your doctor.
And the next one is about schools, whether or not we should close schools during a bad flu outbreak.
Well, what do you think? First off, Christy, as a parent of two school-aged children, what do you think? Would you like to see the schools closed during a flu outbreak, or do you have to put on your doctor hat?
Well, you know, the truth is, as a parent, of course, you don't want the schools to close. You feel like it'd be like snow in North Carolina. People hear of it and we close down all the schools. But this research is convincing to me that it could be a good thing for severe outbreaks.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases, and it was when we had that really bad H1N1 flu epidemic in 2009, and there were two large counties in Dallas where one closed their school systems before there was a severe outbreak, and the other did not.
And what they found in was that in the district where the schools shut down, there were fewer emergency room visits for the flu. And also, really more impressively, for the kids six and up, there was no increase in flu-related doctor to ER trips, while the rate in the other community doubled.
The ones that let school happen, yeah. I was impressed that the number of emergency room visits went from 5 to 11% when they had the school. And the other one said, we're going to close down for a week. And that essentially took care of that risk. And I think this raises really profound questions. But it's the right question to ask, both should the school shut down and maybe should you maybe keep your child home, even if the school didn't shut down, if you wanted to cut down on the risk of the flu in a serious outbreak of this type of illness.
And it does. And then how serious does the outbreak have to be? How long should they shut the schools down? How much does that cost for all of us parents who then can't go to work? But if it keeps our children safe, and I mean, people die from the flu still. I mean, something like 36,000 deaths. That is profound. We need to be taking these steps, even if it costs us a little bit of hassle.
Well, I think we're both in agreement on that, even though as parents, we may be needing to go spend some time at home. Let's talk about our next research that matters, though, which is about cheerleading and injuries due to cheerleading. First off, Christy, do you think cheerleading is a sport?
Well, I have to self-disclose that I was a high school cheerleader.
How come that doesn't surprise me?
I love to
cheer. You look athletic.
Well, I love to do gymnastics.
Was it dangerous?
It was. I mean, especially thinking about how much climbing we did in these pyramids and the amount of gymnastics that's involved.
What do you mean a pyramid?
Pyramid where you put people on top of each other to get really high.
So you start with 4, then 3, then 2, then 1. That's like 10 feet off the ground.
It's really high. Well, this is a new guideline about cheerleading, really urging schools to consider it a sport, to have physical exams preseason, to have coaches that are there to supervise and help for strength and conditioning, and to give guidance about how high the pyramids can be and have an emergency plan. It's really an effort to try to reduce the kinds of serious injuries that can come from cheerleading.
Yeah, I think for our listeners out there who have daughters or sons who are cheerleaders, you really understand this. But for everyone else, recognize that there are 3.5 million kids ages 6 and older that are participating in cheerleading, and that there are over 25,000 cheerleading injuries a year, and that sport accounts for 2/3 of all catastrophic injuries to high school female athletes. Amazing.
It is amazing. I'm grateful that I made it through and started thinking twice about maybe gearing my daughter towards a different sport. It's really quite dangerous when you consider how high they're coming and then the head and neck injuries that can come from it.
Talk to the coaches, support the legislation. Let's reduce this injury rate significantly. Let's talk about our last research that matters, Christy.
So are you skeptical of new research?
Well, you may know, because I've said this before, but in my patients would even know more, that I'm what's called a late adopter. I like to, when I see new research findings frequently, I let others kind of experiment with it for a while, because sometimes you find out side effects of drugs after they come out and hit the market, or maybe it's not as great as people say. So I'm a late adopter to start with.
Well, this was work that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association to pool more than 3,000 research reviews, and to really look at this question of how much of the research that comes out to show a very large effect on patients then ends up sort of petering out over time, where we discover we were doing the wrong thing.
Particularly research that says there are large changes in things like lab values or things like blood pressure, but not the more important things like did you live longer? And that 90% of those studies aren't as strong as when they first come out. So perhaps when there's a new drug or a new treatment, my take home, Christy, is maybe we should wait a little bit before we jump on that bandwagon.
Well, and sometimes the studies are either small or have other factors. Maybe they were paid for by the drug company, or, you know, lots of different things that can affect the results. So being able to replicate it with other people and other studies is important. So this is sort of a nice reminder for us all to have a little healthy skepticism.
A little more humility.
That every bit of research
always
right.
Even as doctors.
That's true.
Christy, that'll conclude our research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about generic drugs and information about side effects, regardless of whether they're brand name or generic.
About whether schools should close during a bad flu outbreak and potential real benefits to protect our
children. Short answer is we support that. And also we support more protection for the sport of cheerleading.
And finally, we support a little healthy skepticism of new research. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with UNC oncologist and expert Dr. Lisa Carey about breast cancer and survivor Barbara Martin about surviving breast cancer. We'll be right back with Your Health.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with UNC oncologist and breast cancer physician in chief of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, Dr. Lisa Carey, along with breast cancer survivor Barbara Martin, about surviving breast cancer. We're so excited to have you here as guest on Your Health.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much.
You know, we are grateful to have this opportunity to hear the perspective of the physician and also of a patient with the experience of surviving breast cancer, and just are grateful that you're here. Would love to have you share with us first, Dr. Carey, about how you became passionate about breast cancer and have really become an expert in this field in your career.
Oh, wow. That goes back a ways. So I actually started as a researcher before I became a physician. So I had done a lot of research in various fields, you know, infectious diseases and cardiovascular work and things like that. When I was a resident, I started to become interested in oncology because that was the place where so many of the changes were happening so quickly. So from a research standpoint, it was an incredibly exciting place. This would be in the 90s. But I was worried it would be depressing. And so it really wasn't until I was in the middle of my residency when I got to meet patients and realized that they were pretty inspirational, as you'll hear from Barbara, and that you could learn as much from the patients. It was actually pretty remarkable to me. So I liked the patients so much that I decided that I wouldn't be depressed. I'd actually think it was a wonderful place to be.
Well, I know that UNC Healthcare and the region of the Triangle, as well as through your research, the rest of the world is grateful for that. And I wonder, Ms. Martin, when did you first meet Dr. Carey? And help us bring in this conversation of the elephant in the room, which is a cancer diagnosis and a breast cancer diagnosis for a woman.
Sure. So I was diagnosed in 2009 with stage 1 breast cancer, and I was actually working at Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center at the time. So that's where I had my surgery. And then, so I thought I was done with surgery. Everything was, you know, moving past. I was going to have reconstruction. And then I found out that my tumor size was just a little bit bigger than expected. And because I was a triple negative, had triple negative breast cancer.
Meaning,
well, Dr. Carey can describe that a little bit more, but that I was negative for estrogen, Herceptin, and what's the third?
Progesterone.
There we go.
Yeah.
That they recommended I have 4 rounds of preventive chemotherapy. And since I live in Raleigh and didn't want to drive all the way up to Winston-Salem, I said, well, I've got to find the very best person around here. And so that's when they recommended Dr. Carey.
And so you had to establish a new relationship after you'd already had the diagnosis. And how did that happen? You just showed up and said, here I am. I hope I'm going to like you. I hope I'm going to trust you. How did you sort of approach that emotion of unloading all that to a new person?
Sure. It's such a whirlwind going through. And I think the benefit of going through a comprehensive cancer center, and we have three in the state, is you meet a whole lot of people at one time, a whole lot of healthcare providers. So I felt like I was getting great care at Wake Forest. But I knew because this was a comprehensive cancer center that I was going to, I think, find similar kind of folks. Mm-hmm. And so with Dr. Carey's reputation, I was actually very excited to meet her. And as a public health advocate, I am a public health professional. After all, I was, you know, jumping in and wanting to talk to everybody that I could to find out how, for me, to manage what I affectionately call my craziness, that period of time when I was going through breast cancer.
Well, you know, Dr. Carey, I wonder, from a provider's perspective, it seems when I went to medical school and training back in the 18th century, but it seemed then that breast cancer was a serious illness, and I know it still is, but somewhere along the line, I think I realized that I was dealing with my patients with something that wasn't a terminal disease as much as a chronic illness. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, when did that happen, and how does this influence when you have someone like Ms. Martin that comes to you, how you have that initial conversation about what it means to be given this diagnosis?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's really been an evolution and a cultural change. You know, my grandmother had breast cancer in the 60s, and nobody knew she had it until it was very far advanced because she didn't tell anyone. It was something that was kept very hush-hush. You know, at that time, there also weren't that many treatments. So I think a couple of things happened, you know, over time. One was there were treatments that took the mortality from breast cancer from about 60% down to about 20%, you know, which is a substantial improvement. So people had hope, so treatments got better. And I think there just was a shift. People started talking about it. This was important to, you know, there were, you know, first ladies were out publicly discussing their mastectomies and I think shedding, you know, it was almost a public health endeavor. And this was true of cancer in general. You hear much more about it. It became less of something that people treated as if, you know, there was some stigma attached to
it. So how then does that translate to how you have a conversation when someone walks in the door? And also, what's that feel like to hear that now? How does that, from both those perspectives?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, as Christy mentioned earlier, I mean, it really is that first meeting is a very emotional one. I mean, it's a very, you know, nobody knows anybody and it's very important. So I think you almost have to take your cue from the patient about how they want to talk about this and how long they want to take, how many different conversations they want to have and how much detail they want, you know, whether it's a patient who wants every bit of detail and every website known to man to look at, from those who want a very straightforward, almost a paternalistic, tell me what I need to do and let's just do it. It really depends on the patient. You have to gauge them.
And how about you, Barbara? Share a little bit about your experience of receiving the diagnosis and how that felt to you in terms of thinking about the future and talking openly with people around you.
Boy, I will never forget that day. So I actually found a lump. My mother had breast cancer 20 years ago, and so I did something I rarely ever did. This is a little embarrassing to admit in front of my oncologist, but I actually just raised up my arm in the shower, and I felt this little pea-sized lump. And so I immediately, that was on a weekend, and immediately on Monday, I called my gynecologist. I said, I've got to come in. I think I'm feeling something. So she got me in. Then she got me in to see, get a mammogram done. And one thing led to another. And I was having a biopsy all in the same day, which was pretty remarkable. I know. And so 2 days later, I get the biopsy result. And this was not from Dr. Carey, because I know she would not have handled it this way. But I remember the physician coming in, and she had a piece of paper in her hand. And she didn't say, I have no idea what she said, but the look on her face, she could not play poker. I knew exactly what the diagnosis was. And after she talked for a while, and like I said, I have no recollection of what she said, what really concerned me is she handed me a piece of paper. It had my diagnosis on it, what the lab reports were, and she had handwritten in two names of two surgeons. And I thought to myself, this is it? you've just given me this huge change of life, and you're just handing me a piece of paper.
Wow.
And that was very different from when I met with Dr. Carey. And one thing that I've always really appreciated, and this is like, I'm not trying to sell you. You're like, everybody come to Dr. Carey. But she really is a fabulous, fabulous oncologist. I know she's incredibly busy. But every time I would come in, she would sit down and make time for me. And I would ask, you know, the silliest questions to the most profound, and feeling like she was giving me her undivided attention and had that knowledge. And I think that really makes a difference.
Well, I know that we want to kind of, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but we want to jump right into an important part of your experience that we know about, which is a journal, a CaringBridge journal, a community of people who care about you, and that this was an integral part of your cancer care. Tell us how that came about. Was this something suggested to you, or did you hear about it? Because I know then hearing the diagnosis, there are so many different stages of what that's like for you.
Oh, well, so a little backstory. I live here in North Carolina, but all my family, all my friends live out in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so I have some very involved, loving parents who wanted to know every little thing that happens with their children because they love us so much. And so instead of making my husband have to call them, you know, plus the old neighbors, plus the great aunt who lives down the road, a friend of mine suggested that I set up a CaringBridge journal, and we started it simply as a way to help my very loving but nosy family know exactly what was happening after I ended up going through three different surgeries. But it ended up being so much more than just sharing information in an efficient kind of way. It really ended up being something that was very central to sort of my therapeutic recovery. Because I ended up blogging, I had 60 entries over the year between diagnosis and me really feeling like it was done. And in that time, I had, I think, 400 guest book entries on this, and I had over 7,000 visits. I'm not sure why everybody was interested in, you know, my little mundane story, but it ended up being very therapeutic to me.
Well, amazing.
It is amazing. And we are looking forward to having you share some of your writing with us and our listeners on the show. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Lisa Carey and Barbara Martin, about surviving breast cancer. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We're continuing our conversation with breast cancer survivor Barbara Martin, an oncologist and chief of the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, Dr. Lisa Carey, about surviving breast cancer. And we started off the last section really almost talking about this term survivorship without really fully defining what that really means. From a provider's perspective, help us understand, what does survivorship of breast cancer, or really any cancer, mean, Dr. Carey?
You know, it's a terrific question because it's actually more heterogeneous than the name implies.
It means many different things.
It means lots of different things. So there's one form of survivorship, which simply is, you know, once you go through your active therapy, and many patients define it this way, when you go through the active time of treatment, the most rigorous time where you're in the hospital frequently, you know, chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, after that's completed, there's a time in which you're being followed and monitored. Maybe you're taking an anti-estrogen pill, but it's a lot less frequent visits, and you become more of a survivor who, you know, is out in the community being more your ordinary self. And that, for many people, is the point at which they consider themselves to have transitioned into the survivorship phase, which can go on their whole life, we hope, because mm-hmm. if the cancer never comes back, then they remain a survivor forever. You know, there is, of course, also the the thing we mentioned in the last segment, where about 1 in 5 of our patients do relapse. And one of the goals of therapy in patients where the cancers come back is trying to control it in a way that lets them live well, even though their cancer has recurred. That's a different kind of survivorship. You know, that's living with a chronic disease kind of survivorship. And those two things are very different. I think in both cases, the thing that is shared is a need to come to grips with this disease. I mean, you have to learn the psychological. I mean, people come to that lots of different ways. You know, Barbara used Caring Bridge. Other people use other means. And we actually have a very engaged psycho-oncology group who's made up of social workers and psychiatrists to help people, you know, kind of marshal the resources of how to deal with this disease that's entered their lives, you know, and for most, hopefully stays there and they live a long, healthy life, but they still have to learn how to have that living with them.
And Barbara, you shared with us before the break your very unique approach using the Caring Bridge Journal to share with your family, but then it also became a way for you to process, or it became something else. Could you share with us an entry just to give us a sense and our listeners a sense of your experience, but also the process of this writing?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm a very open person. I think a lot of cancer patients and survivors can be very private, but I end up being on the complete other end of the spectrum. So just as part of backstory, I had a bilateral mastectomy after finding out that I had the genetic mutation, the breast cancer gene, BRCA1 is what we call it. And so I wrote a journal entry about that when we found out where that BRCA gene came from. And so this was on October 20th, and I titled it, "I Am My Father's Daughter." As I shared earlier, I have the breast cancer gene. Actually, it's a genetic mutation. We all have a certain pair of genes, one passed on by each parent, that make proteins which suppress cell growth. When there's a mutation in one of these genes, it's as if you're driving a car with faulty brakes. Since the genes are passed down from one's parents, we guess that my BRCA1 mutation came from my mother because she had premenopausal breast cancer almost 2 decades ago. Recently, to our great surprise, we discovered that the gene was in fact passed down by my dad. When I was first diagnosed, my mother went through all sorts of emotions, including enormous guilt that she had somehow, quote, given me breast cancer. That must have been excruciatingly painful for her. But now, 5 months after first learning about my genetic defect, it's my dad's turn to feel such agonizing responsibility. Of course, we all know logically that he did nothing of the sort. This gene was passed down to him from his parents and weaves along the family tree. It's an unfortunate bloodline, but there's nothing he could have done to prevent it. It was just a roll of the dice that I got the misspelled gene. But that doesn't make it any easier on him. I so deeply wish I could remove that genetic link for him. One day, we'll have to test my daughter for the gene. My biggest wish is that by the time that day comes, we'll have a cure for breast cancer, and then that little gene with the faulty brakes won't matter anymore.
Wow.
Wow.
Thank you for sharing. That's a very difficult story. True.
Yeah.
But difficult. Dr. Carey, I wonder, from the provider's perspective as an expert in breast cancer, you must wrestle, you know, in advance, you've had these conversations. How do you begin to have the type of conversation that Barbara just discussed in a way that allows all these range of emotions to come flooding out? Is it just time? Does it just take time?
Yeah. I mean, it takes time and trust. I mean, you know, patients, you know, they have different needs. Some don't really want to have, you know, some want to share their emotional state with you. Others very much want to control it. And I think, you know, you have to let them do what lets them feel best about their own, you know, relationship with you, their physician. I mean, as you know, some patients, it's really important to them that they maintain a certain distance or control over the circumstance. Maybe they're afraid they'll come to pieces otherwise. Other people, it's really important that they share with you how they're feeling at the time and that you are a partner with them in that. And I think you have to take your cues from them.
You know, you mentioned that, if I may jump in, that sense of control, I think, was something that was really important to me, because when you get that cancer diagnosis, all of a sudden something else is in control. Cancer is. You're not. You know, you didn't ask for it. You can't just get rid of it on your own. You have to do something to try to get rid of it. You never know if it's going to come back. And so this journaling for me was my very small little way of trying to have a little bit of control. And the cool thing about it being online is I could choose when I shared any part of my story. And, you know, sometimes you get lovely neighbors who want to bring another, you know, tuna casserole over, and you just, as the patient, want to be left alone. So it's nice that I was able to, I could post information when I wanted. I could read people's guestbook entries when I wanted. If I needed an extra little bit of support, I would go back and read, you know, the 400 that had already been on there. And if I wanted to get away from it all, I turned my computer off. It was really, it gave me that little, and maybe it was, you know, all pretend in my own mind, but it gave me that little sense of control.
Sure.
Over cancer.
Did you share that with your physician or any of your medical personnel?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely brought it up to Dr. Carey. And I was surprised when I brought it up to other nurses that not as many nurses and physicians knew about Caring Bridge or were talking about it with their patients. And so Dr. Carey and I actually had an interesting conversation about that.
Well, I know we're going to hear time for maybe one more Caring Bridge journal entry, but I wonder before that, Dr. Carey, if you can just talk about, as we think about all the people who are living with cancer and surviving, what types of things do you give about control and maintaining control? Because you must see this and hear about it from so many different perspectives.
I have to say the one piece of advice that I routinely give patients, and I know I did with Barbara, is that it's the hardest time is not going through surgery or going through chemo or going through radiation, because there's a lot of support there and there's a lot going on, and patients can marshal their resources to get through these identifiable hurdles. The hardest time is usually right after that, when you're done with the active part and you're now in a kind of just a surveillance, you're just being monitored, but you're being handed the piece of paper saying come back in 3 months. And that's when people struggle the most psychologically. And I tell them, almost because when I was younger and didn't realize this was so much a part of the psyche, that, you know, I mean, one patient said to me, I have no dragon to slay. Right? I mean, it's really, you can create a structure, and how am I going to get through my chemo, and how am I going to get my kids taken care of while I'm not there, and how am I going to do this? But then there isn't much to do. So patients would come in and they say, I must be going crazy. I should be having parties. Why am I having such a hard time with this? And it really, that the psychology of this process is really important. So I think, you know, There's so much differences amongst people in how they manage the things that they can manage, but that's the one thing I found uniformly, is that you need your friends and your posse the most when you're entering the follow-up phase.
And do either of you have a recommendation for our listeners out there, or people who are in that phase and sort of facing life ahead, of what kinds of things, you know, how to carry on?
Well, I remember talking to Dr. Carey's nurse navigator, and I was telling her, you know, I feel positive. I feel, you know, that I can handle all this. I'm going through the chemo. I'm doing fine. And she said, if you don't end up in the closet, in other words, crying in the closet, I'll be worried about you. And that, it was interesting when she said that, I thought, well, gosh, I'm a very positive person. I'll never end up in the closet. I had that hit me. And what was really interesting, and I wrote a journal entry about it. It's kind of long and it's kind of depressing, so I don't know if I'm going to read the whole thing. But I ended up talking in my journal entry about feeling like I was a bit of a fraud, because I felt that I'd been so positive up to that point in all of my journal entries. And as I titled it, I said, this is not a happy entry. And I got so many responses back from people saying, far from you being a fraud, you have just allowed yourself to feel the full range of emotions that you have going through cancer, and that's completely normal and that's completely okay. And you're going to be a better survivor for it. And so once I accepted that, I thought, okay, you know, the heartache is all right.
Well, you know, I really want to thank you for sharing that. But I've in all confession, I've in the public health sphere, Barbara, I've known you for a long time, and I have known you as someone that's full of enthusiasm and laughter. And before we came on, you said you also had a Caring Bridge entry that was funny. And I'm just kind of curious in maybe our last minute, if you'd be willing to share that with us, because that is also, I know, really part of who you are as well.
Oh, sure. Well, I've got a lot of them.
We'll have to have a shorter one.
Yes, absolutely. So one that I picked out, I actually called it a silly scenario. And it was after my second surgery where, as I said before, I had breast reconstruction. And so that was a process. But after my second surgery where they were taking out expanders and putting in the actual implants, I wrote this entry. And so I said, "There's always something weird or funny that seems only to happen to me. This time was no exception. Both involved how I was, quote, packaged up in the Northern Hemisphere. Once I made it back to my recovery room, Dr. D, my reconstructive surgeon, came to visit and check out my chest. To my great surprise, I just had this white, fairly loose tube top across my breasts. My greatest fear, which he was well aware of, was that these implants would migrate to the armpits, just as the expanders had done. So Dr. D did a total MacGyver. He brazenly commandeered the safety pins that were affixed to my surgery drains, and he put them on the tube top. And that he took out about 4 inches of slack in that tube top. I asked him if this was the innovative and highly technical procedure used by reconstructive surgeons these days. He gamely said yes. But later, I ratted him out to one of my nurses as the safety pin thief. Still under the influence of serious painkillers, I explained my predicament and asked her if I could borrow her bra to help keep the implant stationary. She just laughed and said she would have to wrap it around me twice and knot it in the back to get it to fit me. So we nixed the idea. We had a good laugh over that.
Well, oh, goodness, thank you for sharing. This has been, I mean, even those two entries are just so powerful in the range of emotions that we've even just, you know, touched on today. Thank you both for being with us today, Dr. Carey and Barbara, and sharing your experience and inspiring those of us in healthcare and our listeners about surviving breast cancer.
You're very welcome.
And we'll be sure to put a link on our website about the resources of the Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Cancer Hospital at UNC for breast cancer and survivorship, as well as perhaps some link about the Caring Bridge Journal for any of our listeners or family members who may be undergoing anything similar.
Sure, and I'm happy to share my Caring Bridge Journal with anybody, and I can put this link on your website as well, for anybody who's going through breast cancer or any kind of cancer.
That's
great. Might give comic relief or at least give a little more insight.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you'd like a question you'd like us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's listen to our very first House Call.
My daughter took photos in the hospital of her sick grandmother and brought them to school for an art project. It upset some of her classmates, but she thought it was art. What do you recommend?
Well,
that's a tough one.
I don't think it's art in the way that doctors and the new HIPAA confidentiality regulations would allow us to.
Well,
to do.
Although if it's her own family member and your family is okay with it, you know, there is something called art therapy, and for her this might be a way to process those things. But I would encourage you to talk openly with your daughter about it. Talk openly with the teacher. Consider some grief counseling if that could sort of be a part of this as well.
Yeah, and I think the teachers as well, letting the teachers know, because they're the interface between the students and everything else that occurs. And also, is it okay with your grandmother and that whole element? There's all kinds of complications here. We're probably not the best ones from provider physician levels to really understand this, but we certainly are aware of it because we have to be very careful who we share things with.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our next house call. Thank you for sharing.
When you start a medicine for high blood pressure, why do doctors sometimes start you out at a pretty high dose? Recently, I was given lisoprolol, a new medicine for high blood pressure, at a dose of 10 milligrams a day. I felt really dizzy for a while, and when I went back in to see another doctor, they said the dose was too high to start with for me. What are your thoughts?
You know, the general rule has been, and you've said this many times on the show, Adam, start low and go slow.
What do you think, Christy? Is 10 milligrams starting low and going slow, or is that a little too fast maybe on that train?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a judgment call based on your blood pressure, your age, what the doctor knows of your response to other medications, perhaps. But it's not extreme.
It's not extreme, but it's probably for my vantage take, it wouldn't be my principles. It's a little bit too much for most people because there's no reason really for most cases why you'd have to start that high. Particularly that particular medicine, you can start as low as 2.5 milligrams or 5 milligrams would be a common starting dose. So if it made you dizzy, probably was a little too much.
Have that conversation with your doctor and hopefully you can find a dose that works to lower it without the side effects.
Yeah, and you might still be dizzy, but it might not be quite as bad. We hope that works. Thank you for sharing a very good question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
My daughter woke up with red eye, with no other symptoms, no cough, no congestion. Should I wait a day or two to see if it resolves or go to the doctor for antibiotics?
This is a very common scenario, and I would encourage you if to wait if you can. If the eye is really filled with pus or really painful, then yes, go to the doctor. But if there's no other symptom and it's sort of mildly irritated, then waiting a day or two is a very reasonable approach.
Yeah, particularly because like over 90% or something really high of these are a virus or not bacterial. And the doctor really isn't going to do very much other than maybe tell you to use artificial tears, which you could get on your own because they're not by prescription. Well, good luck with that. And thank you for house calls, as well as really all the house calls today, as well as our great guest today, Christy. We had an amazing guest today with Dr. Carrie and Ms. Barbara Martin.
Mm-hmm. We do want to thank you for being with us today and thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And again, our guests today, Dr. Lisa Carey and Barbara Martin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.